boy, this is going to be so much fun, because this is it, folks. This is the entire semester in one presentation. This is where we discuss the relationship of risk versus return, risk versus reward. Do you want to eat well, or do you want to sleep well? So, should you listen to this a couple of times? I hope so. Slide 35. Investment Return Revisited. Over the long term, and what do we mean? 10, 20, 30, 40 years, folks. Stocks, equities. Stocks, remember, equities, we're taking Introduction to Investment, so we call them equities. Everybody else calls them stocks. They've produced the best returns. When we're discussing financial investments, now let's leave real estate out of this because real estate's a very different animal. Stocks have returned 8 to 12%. Well, I usually, as we've said, tell people 8 to 10% to temper their expectations so they don't jump up and down and scream and holler when they don't get 11, 12, 13%. Fixed income securities, bonds, loans, have returned 4 to 8% over the long term, remembering that not always will they return that. Sometimes they'll return more, sometimes they'll return a lot less, and right now they're returning less. But treasury and muni bonds, 4, 5, 6%, corporate bonds, 6, 7, 8% over the long term. And short-term investments, cash, savings accounts, treasury bills, money market mutual funds, anywhere from 2 to 5% over the long term. Right now, they're paying a lot less. Mutual funds will more or less, often less, reflect the underlying assets that they invest in. Okay, so have you memorized these numbers, remembering that they're fuzzy, that they're not exact, but these are generalities over long terms, over long periods of time. Slide number 36. This is a graphic from the sixth edition of the book, and the sixth edition was revised in 2010, so they go up to 2009. And we see that since 1925, now why do we pick the 1920s? There's a few historical reasons. Sometimes we go back to 1910, sometimes later. But there are some historical reasons with regard to how finance and business was conducted in the modern world. And so there's some good reasons for that. We won't get into those, but there's some reasons why we use those numbers, those dates. And what we find is that stocks have done pretty darn well, folks. You know. Now, what I want you to do throughout this presentation is ignore small company stocks. And even the people who make these numbers will tell you, well, you know, they're not the best. It's not the best data. Why is that? Because small companies have what are called survivorship bias. Many small companies don't survive, and so you don't see what happened to their stocks. And so it tends to askew. There's a funny word that you might want to look up, skew, or alter in a unusual manner the return for small company stocks. But so let's take a look at large company stocks. So a dollar, if you had invested a dollar back in 1925, well, the first few decades it would have been pretty rough, but eventually, as the global economy came out of the Great Depression and World War II, stocks did pretty darn well. Now, this looks like a somewhat straight line. It's a little bumpy, but what we have to look at is the scale on the left-hand side. And they use a logarithmic scale, where every increment is a factor of 10 larger. Now, they really shouldn't, but they can't. They can't not use this logarithmic scale, because what you would see is virtually nothing, and then you'd see a big jump. Why? Because it's exponential growth. So we use logarithmic scales to plot exponential growth because it makes it look like a straight line. And it doesn't look that bumpy, But what you have to remember is that the numbers get larger as you get bigger, so these drops here are pretty darn big, even though they look small. That's pretty good, don't you think? A dollar turns into $2,300, $2,400. The long-term government bond has done not bad, $75. And then what we see is that treasury bills, $22, and inflation did $12. So treasury bills, which are short-term investments, have, you know, done better than inflation, but not much. Bonds have beaten inflation, handily, but still, look at how well stocks have done. Exactly. So maybe now you might understand opportunity cost. If you need the money soon, well, you're stuck. You got to stay with short-term investments. But if you don't need the money for a while, by not taking the extra risk of large company stocks, you've given up tremendous opportunity. It doesn't mean you haven't lost money. At times you have, as those little bumps, which translate into big numbers, attest to. But you now see that stocks have done pretty darn well, even after the big drops that have occurred throughout this period. And in fact, if we extend our time horizon to over 200 years, it turns out that stocks have done darn well. Oh my goodness. A dollar turned into almost $11 million. And bonds have done pretty darn good, but oh boy, aren't they dwarfed by stocks. Treasury bills have beaten the inflation, but, you know, handily, but have not done as well as bonds, and nowhere near as well as stocks. And what I really like about this graph is that it also shows how well gold has done. Folks, gold is a silly investment. Think about it, folks. Does it pay any interest or dividends or rent? Does it grow? Does it find new markets? Does it develop new products? No, it doesn't do anything. It looks good. And J.P. Morgan said it best. He said, you've heard of Chase Bank? Yeah, J.P. Morgan. Yeah, right. He said, gold is money and nothing else. It really isn't. And so you see that over the long term, gold has basically kept up with inflation. And gold does well when the world is about to end. 1860s? Yeah, right, the Civil War. 1930s, Depression, World War II, 1940s. And then gold started to rise dramatically as inflation rose in the 1970s, only to hit a peak in 1981 and then fall for the next 20 years. The last 10, 12 years, gold has done very well. But when you compare it to stocks, folks, give me a break. So we'll come back to precious metals way at the end of the course, but we find that as a long-term investment, gold barely keeps up with inflation. Great. Okay. So now that we are armed with this information, what kind of returns we've seen in the past, and, you know, maybe see in the future, that's not a guarantee. How do we relate this to risk? Slide number 38. Investment risk. It is no accident, folks, that stocks and bonds have produced better returns than short-term investments, than just inflation, than cash. Otherwise, why would investors assume the higher risk of stocks and bonds, right? Why bother? If stocks and bonds are going to return the same amount as short-term guaranteed or pretty darn close investments, why would you bother investing in them? Why wouldn't investors simply assume what is called the risk-free rate of return? Now, I want you to learn that term. It refers to investments that are essentially guaranteed, that are as good as gold, so to speak. And when we talk about the risk-free rate of return, we usually are referring to the return on 3-month U.S. Treasury bills. Now, it depends on who you talk to, but most people will use the 3-month Treasury bill return, the interest rate that they're paying. And by the way, part of your assignment for Chapter 1 is to go research these things on a wonderful website called treasurydirect.gov. And of course, take a look at the assignment sheet and it'll explain it in more detail. So when people say, what's the risk-free rate of return? I don't know. Go look up and see what Treasury bills are, 3-month Treasury bills are paying. Now, some people might use 6 months or 4 week or whatever, but they mostly use Treasury bills. You see, for us to bear that extra risk, for us to accept that extra risk, we want some kind of premium. We want a risk premium. We want a reward for bearing risk, or specifically the extra return on a risky asset over the risk-free rate of return. Okay, so if we're going to take stocks or bonds and accept the risk, what are we going to get in return? What is our risk premium? And here is another graphic from your 6th edition. Of course, if you have the 4th or the 5th, the numbers are going to be a little different, but not much. They're very similar over the long term. And it turns out that stocks, as much as, you know, sometimes people hate them, and as much as sometimes people love them, and sometimes they're the best thing since sliced bread, and sometimes they're the work of the devil, but over the long term, they've returned almost 12%. Pretty darn good. Remember, we tell people 8, 9, 10%. And we see that they have a risk premium of 3.9. Well, where'd you get that? If you jump down to the bottom of the graphic, you'll see that U.S. Treasury bills over 80-some-odd years have returned 3.8%. So you take the 11.7% that you've gotten from stocks, you subtract 3.8% that you've returned from Treasury bills. You're paying a whole lot less than this now, 0.3% or 0.1%, and you get that 7.9% risk premium. Now, again, I want you to ignore small company stocks. You might be jumping up and down saying, I'm going to invest in small company stocks. You look at mutual funds that invest in small company stocks, and you very rarely see 17.7%. Why is that? Because we're only looking at the companies that survive. Now, long-term corporate bonds, 6.5%, much less than the large company stocks, so much less premium, risk premium, 2.7%. And notice that government bonds have 5.9%, which is, you know, not quite as good as the corporate bonds. Why? Because the government not going out of business. I don't care what anybody says. It is not going to default. And you see a risk premium of 2.1%. Well, again, where did we get that? We just subtracted the 6.5% or the 5.9% minus the 3.8% of the Treasury bills. And of course, there's no risk premium for investing in Treasury bills because you're not taking any risk. Does that make sense? Yeah, it does. It does. Think about it. It does make sense. Slide number 40, risk versus reward, risk versus return. As we said, investment return is very straightforward to measure. How much did you start with? How much did you end with? What was your time frame? That's your return. But measuring risk, as most people think of risk, but measuring the harm that can be incurred, but measuring how much risk you took to receive that return is much more difficult. There is no good measurement. There are several measures, and the one that we use the most, the one that you hear people quote the most, and the one that people use the most, is standard deviation. Each year, the investment community measures the average annual return over so many years, and the amount of variance, deviation from the average return. And using statistics, the resulting measures of risk are called variance and standard deviation. Now, I don't want you to drop the class. I don't want you to go screaming into the night saying, we gotta do stats! No, folks. Slide number 41, we leave the calculations when you take statistics class. Why? Because all you do is you go look it up on the internet and there it says, there's the standard deviation. You don't have to calculate it. Suffice to say that the higher the variance and standard deviation, the riskier the investment. The higher the variance and standard deviation, the more the investment return will deviate from the average annual return. So what does that mean? What does that mean? It means, sure, stocks have returned almost 12%, but in any one year, it's very rarely 12%. It's 17, minus 4, 22, minus 20. Sometimes it's 10, 12%. Very rarely, but sometimes it is. So let's take a look at the, you don't have, folks, you see the little question marks, and you're not going to do this. But what does all this Greek, what do these mathematics mean? Well, if you've taken a stat class, bear with me. You don't have to do this. I'm not going to ask you. The book asks you, but I don't. Because it's all done for you. You take the return in any given year. That's what R sub I means. Return sub year, I, whatever year you're dealing with. And you subtract it from the average return over however many years you're looking at. 40 years, 20 years, 80 years. And then you square it. Why do you square it? Well, that gets rid of negative numbers. You see, if you square a number, it's always positive. And then you do that for however many years you're looking at, and you sum, that's what that sigma, that's the Greek letter sigma, it stands for sum, and you see it on your spreadsheets, right? You do that for however many years you're measuring your return. And then you divide that number by n minus 1, the number of years minus, why is it n minus, it takes statistics, it has to do with the central limit theory, whatever. So you find the variance, the difference from the average annual return by looking at each individual return, subtracting the difference, squaring it so that all the negative signs disappear, and then dividing by the number of years minus 1. And then to get the standard deviation, which is more useful, you take the square root of that. Well, that makes sense. You squared them all. Now you take the square root. And folks, you, as I said, you don't have to do these calculations, and you don't even have to worry that much about the actual numbers themselves, other than to compare them against other investments. Because what these terms are, folks, are just fancy schmancy ways of saying you can lose your money. You understand? You can. You're not going to always get 11.7% every year, or 8%, or 6%, or 4%. Some years it's going to be more, some years it's going to be less, and sometimes it's going to be negative. Slide 42. In fact, we're looking at a graphic now that shows the average annual returns, not the average, I'm sorry, the annual returns, not the average. We already computed the average. That's almost 12%. But the average, the annual returns, sorry, I keep saying average, annual returns from 1926 to 2012. Okay, and what does this mean? Well, look at the years. In, say, 1926, the number was between 10 and 20%. In 1942, it was between 20 and 30%. In 1929, it was between 0 and negative 10%. And so we go up and we see 2012. Well, 2012, the return was between 10 and 20%. And notice that sometimes the returns are stupendous, right? 40% in 1958 and 1954, 50%. 1997, between 30 and 40%. And sometimes they're not much fun at all. 1931, 1930, the Great Depression, 1937, 2001, 2002, 3 years of down markets after almost 20 years of up markets, and then 2008. Yeah. Now, does this distribution resemble anything that you're familiar with? Come on, work with me, folks. You know what this is. It's the normal distribution, also called the bell curve, slide number 43. You see, when you learn about statistics and when you study statistics, you will find that a whole lot of things in life, not everything, but a whole lot of things in life, when plotted over the long term, or if you get a population that's very large, they tend to mirror the normal distribution. There's an average, yes, but there's a variance, a deviation from that average. And sometimes the deviation is very, very small, and sometimes it's quite large. And in any normal distribution, when you move one or, you know, plus one or minus one standard deviation, you find that about two-thirds, 68% of the data points, whatever it happens to be, the height of boys 14 years old, or the length of a car battery will last, or the return on your stock investment, 68% of the time, about two-thirds, it will fall within one standard deviation of the average. In 95% of the time, it will fall within two standard deviations. And in 99% of the time, actually more than 99% of the time, it will fall within three standard deviations. So investment returns over time tend to mirror a normal distribution. We tell people that stocks are going to give us 8, 9, 10% over the long term. We don't tell them that it's up almost to 12. Shh, don't tell them that. We tell them it's 8, 9, 10%. But in any given year, you don't know what it's going to be. And don't let anybody tell you they do know. There's people who are paid tremendous sums of money to incorrectly predict where the stock market is going. Can you imagine if they actually could predict? And if they could, would they actually tell you? So you understand? We're going to get, Lord willing and the crick don't rise and the world doesn't fall apart, we're going to get 8, 9, 10% from our stocks over the long term, unless the economy falls and completely crashes. But in any one year, we're not going to get 8, 9, 10%. And much of what we get depends on whether we panic at the wrong time when the market falls, and if we get giddy and euphoric when the market does well. So, this next slide, on slide 44, is trying to show you the distributions of small company, large company, the corporate bonds, the U.S. government bonds, the intermediate term bonds, the treasury bills, and inflation. And there's a big problem with this graph, and I've racked my brains trying to show you how it would look in reality. The problem with this graph is that all the maximums look the same, don't they? They're about the same size. Wrong. That's not, these scales are all wrong. You see, these maximums would be a whole lot less than the maximums for the bonds, which would be a whole lot less than the maximums for the treasury bills and inflation. You understand? Yeah. See, it's because the distributions for large company stocks and small company stocks are very wide. The variance and standard deviation is large. As you go to bonds, because bonds are less risky, as measured by standard deviation, and in reality, as measured by our definition of loss of harm, of loss of principal and harm and risk, the standard deviation gets less. And then as we go down to intermediate bonds and treasury bills, the standard deviation gets even narrower. And then when we get to inflation, it is the narrowest. So, the greater the standard deviation, the wider the distribution of returns, and the riskier of the investment as measured by standard deviation and as measured by the fact that you might not get what you expected to get in any one year. So you got that? Make sure you understand that these numbers are not all the same. I'm trying to figure out a better way to show these graphs, but hopefully you got the idea, and if not, contact me. So, again, another graphic from your book, this is from the 6th edition, on slide 45, shows the average annual return versus standard deviation in a different manner. Here's the deviation as it gets larger the average annual return gets larger. So it's just another way of looking at it. If it helps, great. If it doesn't, ignore the slide. If it doesn't make sense to you, if you really hate math and you hate graphs, then just ignore it. But for those of you who like math and don't care that much, it isn't that hard, folks. Really, sit down and relax and open your eyes and you'll find that it's not that difficult. As the standard deviation gets larger, then our annual return gets larger. And again, ignore small company stocks because you're going to think that you're going to get rich with small company stocks. And you're going to give yourself an ulcer with small company stocks. Slide number 46. So, now we can complete the global picture regarding risk versus return. Do you remember this slide? This slide back in the previous the very first presentation, when we showed how well Sweden versus the Netherlands and then the UK and then the United States and Canada and then Singapore, Japan, and Italy, we showed how well the 18 largest economies gross domestic product per capita, in other words, what each individual produces over the population. And we said that Sweden and the Netherlands and Denmark and Switzerland and France and Australia, not too much, but certainly Sweden and the Netherlands and Denmark made us look sad, right? Made the, United States only 9.5%. Well, sure, folks. Sweden may have had the best average annual return. Yeah, sure, 14%. Ooh, and I'm not even going to try to mimic a Sweden accent. I can't do it. They had to accept, the investors who invested in Sweden, had to accept 60% more risk. You see, the United States was 15.8. But the standard deviation for Sweden was almost 25%. Not quite double, but pretty close to double what the standard deviation was in the United States. So in fact, we had the best. Look at, we're the best in terms of deviation, in terms of a bumpy ride. Sure, your money went up faster, you got a better return from these countries, but it went down faster and up and down. And if you didn't have the stomach to hold on while you were sitting on that roller coaster, what did you do? You sold at the bottom, only to wait for it to skyrocket back up and then bought at the top, right? The term, you've heard it over and over again, is buy low, sell high. But what do? We're humans. We buy high and we sell low. So who had the best risk-adjusted return? You bet we did. United States. There's a reason why our stock markets, our capital markets, our bonds are coveted by the rest of the world. Because we're that much more stable. Now, having said that, it's still a roller coaster ride investing in stocks, but it's been far less if you invested in the United States market over the last quarter century. Got it? Okay, good. Let's continue. Slide number 47. So, does yous got it yet, folks? Yous wants high returns? Yous gonna get high risk. Yous gonna lose some of your money, and maybe all of yous money. And if anybody tells yous different, they're lying. They're lying. You understand, I'm from Philadelphia. I'm Italian. My grandparents were all from Italy. Yeah, folks, yeah, there's no way to get around it. If you're going to want high returns, you're going to have to accept the volatility. As one of my students, the volatility is real! And as we're going to see, those are usually the best times to invest, when everybody else is saying, I'll never touch those Mark stocks again, those guy crooks. That's usually the best time to invest. The worst time to invest is when everyone thinks that stocks are going to the moon in 1999. So, when, not if, you see an advertisement for a 12% safe rate of return, you will know that the chances of losing your money are pretty high. Or it's some other kind of scam. Maybe it's 12% for 3 months. And When you see claims such as 300% or even 3,000%, and if you're involved in investing, you're going to get your name on certain mailing lists and email lists and whatever, you're going to see these claims. Something's going to come in the mail, email is going to fill your email box. When you see these, sit on your hands, grab your wallet, and just delete it, tear it up, or give it to me because I collect them and show them. Oh, by the way, when they offer you 300% or 3,000%, they're also breaking the law. And you might say, well, wait a minute, we have free speech in here. No, no, we don't. When it comes to the securities industry, it is strictly regulated what you can and cannot say to potential investors. And what these people do, and these are just some of them. In fact, you can look up Wade Cook and find that he was eventually put out of business. But no problem. They just start up as another company and take your money. Wise Trade, Day Trading Coach, Optionetics. Check them out, folks. Check them out. See what they'll... We're going to teach you how to make riches beyond your wildest dreams. Just take our guaranteed surefire three-day trading course, only $39.95. That's $3,995. But if you sign up today, folks, what we're going to do for you is lower it to only $3,495. Plus, we don't charge you the shipping and handling. And we all know that in your basement or in your garage or somewhere in the attic, you have something that's worth over $3,000 that you don't even use. So you know that this is going to make you money beyond your wildest dreams. So don't worry about putting it on your credit card. Don't worry about putting it on your home equity line of credit. You're going to pay that loan off in 1 month, folks. This is the spiel that they give. I've seen it, folks. I've gone to their presentations. I feel that if I had no ethics, I probably could make a lot of money, folks. The problem is I have this horrible affliction called ethics. I have to live with myself. Anyway, you understand, you can't get away from the eternal struggle of risk versus return, risk versus reward. But you might ask, well, Piano, isn't somebody doing it? Slide 48. Well, it is true. Some people make eye-popping, tremendous rates of return. But those people are not investors, folks. They are traders. They are speculators. And sure, being a trader can be very profitable, but it is also very stressful and incredibly perilous. And you're up against the best in the world. I use sports analogies, and I don't know if they work well, but for me they work. If you can strike out less than 4 or 5 times, and get a hit 3 times out of 10 in the major leagues, you're going to make millions. But you have to be able to hit a fastball at 97 miles an hour. Have you ever been in those batting cages? My highest speed was 60, and that was it. I said, no thanks, no more of this. Yeah, right. And so what I want you to do, maybe not now, but in the face-to-face class, what I would do right now is read the story of John Goodfreund. Good friend is what it translates into, versus John Merriweather. It's a wonderful story, folks, from a book that's in the bibliography, and it really shows what you're up against. These people are ruthless. They have to be. They have to be because they are pitted against the best in the world. They have to be better. And another great resource I want you to take a look at is an interview from 2009 in the midst of the debacle between October 2008 and March of 2009, the market lost, what, 50-60%? Oh, boy. And this was in the beginning of 2009. And Steve Forbes, Forbes magazine, you might have seen this guy, you might not. He ran for president a few times. And he interviews some of the best in the industry. And thankfully, last time I checked, the interview is still online. You want to look at the section called Emotion is the Enemy. Emotion is the Investor's Enemy. You can watch the whole thing. But what I do in the classroom is just show that initial part where Steve Forbes asks John Bogle, how do you get people to understand that emotion is their enemy? And Mr. Bogle, who, by the way, was responsible for the world's largest mutual fund company. You've heard of Vanguard? Yeah, he's retired now, but he was the one who saw the opportunity and turned Vanguard into the world's largest mutual fund company. He just says it so plainly, so matter of fact. He says the first thing you have to realize, the first thing you have to determine is, are you an investor or are you a speculator or a trader? They mean the same thing, trader, speculator. Are you going to invest for the long term, own companies, businesses that make new products, that find new markets, or are you going to say, I can buy this for $10 and sell it for $12 or $20? And if you're a trader, if you're a speculator, I wish you the best of success. But you know what? I ain't going to be able to help you. I don't think I can. I can't hit a fastball at 97 miles an hour. I'm not going to get into those pits and try to buy something at 10 and sell it at 12 and then buy it again at 11 and sell it at 13. No, it's very difficult. And if you can do it, congratulations. I wish you the best of success. But good luck is all I can say. You're probably going to lose. Slide number 48. So, what is a realistic rate of return for me, for you, right? For you watching this or listening to this. After you have taken this course, you will have a strong knowledge of the most popular types of investments: stocks, bonds, cash, instruments, mutual funds. You will also know what levels of returns and what levels of risk you should reasonably expect to receive. And if you are a patient, long-term investor, I believe it is realistic to expect 8, 9, 10% over the long term. I am certainly working on it myself and have been doing so for quite some time. And I want to tell you that so far so good, even after 2008. Of course, as we will reiterate time and time again, there are no guarantees. If you leave the wonderful world of treasury bills, of money market mutual funds, of passbook savings accounts, you are not guaranteed the rate of return that you may believe you're going to get. Slide number 50. So, is 8, 9, 10% good enough, you may ask? But is that good enough? Well, it turns out the answer to this question is yes. But there are some caveats. There are some conditions we're going to place on you. You need to start early. You need to be patient and consistent. You do not get too cocky or greedy. And you do not chase after every next big thing that comes along. And most importantly, you see it's bold, you don't panic when the market swoons, because it's going to happen. 2008 is going to happen again. Now, I don't know when. I don't know if it's going to be next year or 10 years from now or 20 years from now. It seems to happen every 10 to 20 years, so we'll see. Because it's going to happen, you have to be ready for that. In fact, it turns out that those are the best times to keep investing. Those are the best times to put money in. Because if you continued to put your $50, $100, or you got that inheritance and whatever, cash bonus, and put it in 2008 or 9, you've done pretty darn well over the last 4 or 5 years. You know, not as, you know, it hasn't felt good, because it's been bouncing, but it turned out okay. The trick is to take advantage of the time value of money, also called compound annual return. The time value of money. Now, we're not going to spend too much time on the time value of money, no pun intended. We will later on when we discuss present value. But in the financial planning and money management class, we spend a great deal of time discussing this in the very first chapter. So we have a couple of exercises that I want you to do, but we're not going to ask you to do them on the exam. They're not have to be submitted. The time value of money is the amount to which a sum you invest now will increase based on a specified rate of return and time period. Calculating amounts into the future is called compounding. It's also called, as we said, the future value of money. Now, we can do this for a lump sum principal, a single payment, a single amount, or we can do it for a series of deposits, a stream of investments, $50 a month, $100 a month. Now, we also hear people use the term annuity. Now, you have to be careful. I don't like using that term because people get it confused with the insurance product by the same name. But any series of investments, any series of cash flows is also called an annuity. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to learn when we get to the heart of the course is how to go from the future back to the present. Now, that's called discounting, the present value of money. And we're going to learn how to do that. And if there's one thing you're going to learn by the end of this semester, it's how to use the present value. It's not that hard, really. It looks scary at first, but once you do it a couple times, you know, this isn't that hard at all. So we're going to learn how to do that. And so in the face-to-face class, if we have time, and usually we don't, at least not the last few semesters, we would sit down and do some of these future value calculations. They're on the website. The answer key is there. There's a commentary. I walk you through these. So go ahead and do these, but realize they're not required for you to be submitted, and they're not part of your assignment. I just said that. They're not going to be on the exam. So if you want to do these, great. If you don't want to do these, great. But if you take the 121 class at the same time, which some people do, the financial planning and money management, you're going to have to do these, and they're required assignments. So slide 53, one last comment on risk versus return. Psst. Here is one of Paiano's secret tips. Avoid large losses. Why? Because they're difficult, right? They're very difficult to recover from. Where would you put $100? In year number one, investment A does 85%. Woo, woo, woo! Not bad. A year, number one, investment B does 10%.
I only did 10% and my neighbor did 85%.
But in year number two, investment A goes down 50%. And investment B actually goes up 9%. And folks, these are real numbers. The NASDAQ went up 85% in 1999. It then took 2.5 years to go down 50%, but it still went down 50%. So you might say, well, shoot, I'm still up 30% if I take investment A, aren't I? Wrong. The numbers don't work the same going up as they do going down. After 1 year, your $100 becomes $185 for investment A. For investment B, it becomes $110. But a 50% loss brings that $185 down to $92. Yeah. That's why, you know, shooting for the fences, throwing the Hail Mary pass, investing everything in small company stocks can be very, very perilous. Now, before we embark on the process of identifying and familiarizing ourselves with the longer term, higher yielding investments, let us learn how and where to park our money using short term investments. But first, wait a second, one more time. The greater the variance in standard deviation of the average annual returns of an investment, the greater the risk, also known as the more volatile, the lesser the risk, the lesser the volatile. There is no correlation, there is no relationship, or standard what? I always hated statistics. What is the greater the variance in standard deviation? Right. The greater the risk as measured by the volatility, how far up and down it goes. Now, folks, don't get this wrong on the exam. It's bad for my self-esteem. I can't get them to understand that this is the most important thing of the class, that you have to understand that the higher the standard deviation, the greater the risk, and you may lose a lot of money. So get it right. Get it right and bring honor and glory and to Southwestern Community College. All right. Now, you're going to go back and do this again, aren't you? Yes, you are. Put it on your MP3 player, your iPod or whatever it's called, and listen to it while you go to work or go to school or ride your bike or whatever. and listen to it a few times. When we come back, we're going to spend a little bit of time, not much, because these things are really not that difficult to comprehend or understand, and discussing short-term investments. Where do we park our money? Okay? Great. I'm so proud of you folks. Keep it up every day. Listen to these, read these, write down your notes, study, read the book. You're going to be fantastic investors. See ya!